Daniel 7 and 8 aren't too hard to understand, right? Much of the interpretation is given by the angels. They are, in fact, both expounding upon the dream of Nebuchadnezzar's image of a man in varying metals. While Nebuchadnezzar saw the preceding nations after him as metals, Daniel saw them as beasts. Chapter 7 deals with how these nations will be militarily until the time of the end. Chapter 8 deals with how two of these nations will treat the nation of Judah. The winged lion, like the gold head, is Babylon. It being given the heart of a man relates to Nebuchadnezzar going from beast to man in chapter 4. The lopsided bear is Persia, with the Persians being the higher shoulder and the Medes being the lower shoulder. The Aramaic word for bear is the same as the Hebrew, dab, and relates to the slowness of a bear. Persia was slow and methodical as it took out its enemies one by one. The three bones in its mouth represent the three nations it had devoured: Babylon, Egypt, and Lydia. The leopard, by contrast, represented the exceedingly fast Greek Empire, which, through Alexander the Great, conquered the known world in a mere 10 years. After his death in a drunken orgy in Babylon, his kingdom was split into four amongst his four generals, represented by the four heads, and the expanse of those kingdoms is represented by the four wings. The fourth unnamed beast is most likely a crocodile, based upon the Aramaic word emtani, translated terrible, and its correlation to the red dragon of Revelations. The fourth beast is obviously the Roman Empire, corresponding to the iron of the image. The ten horns likewise can correspond to the 10 toes of Nebuchadnezzar's image, and represent either 10 literal kings, or figuratively, a multitude of kings, which may be considered Roman, but are relatively weak in comparison. Three of these kings fall under the authority of a new horn, with eyes and a mouth. This little horn is the papacy, that pretends to have eyes like that of the Most High, which it terms the Holy See. But the vision declares that it has the eyes of a weak and mortal man. The little horn uses its mouth to speak words against the Most High. The three horns which fell were the Exarchate of Ravenna, the Kingdom of Lombardy, and the State of Rome. The Triregnum, or Triple Crown, is a testament to the temporal reign of the Pope. That's what the Pope wears, not today, but beforehand. Today, the Pope no longer wears this crown, since he has no more temporal power. This man even has the audacity to change times and seasons, which Daniel states that the Most High does in chapter 2. The Church adopted the Roman solar calendar, which Pope Gregory XIII altered to align with the solstices in 1582. This solar calendar still bears the names of its Roman pagan deities and emperors. Even the English words that we use for the weeks, the days of our weeks, are no different, as each one is pagan in origin. Sunday, Sunday, Monday, Moon Day. Tuesday is Tyr's Day. Wednesday is Odin's Day. Thursday is Thor's Day. Friday is Freya's Day. And Saturday is Saturn's Day. Even the planets in the sky are named after Roman gods. You got Jupiter, Mars, Mercury. They're all Roman gods. Even the word that we use, God, to describe the deity, is pagan in origin. The word God is from the Germanic Gott, which is the name of a deified tribal leader from which the German barbarians known as the Goths originate. Norse mythology identifies Gott as one of the names of Odin, and they call him Odin Gott. All of his progeny, which he is the supreme deity, also known as the Valfather, his progeny are also equally Gott. Like all people from Adam are called Adam, all people from Israel are called Israel, all people from Gott are called Gott. And this is where we get the name God. The little horn thus blasphemes the Most High with paganism and the altering of times and seasons and names. At the end of the vision, Daniel witnesses a great trial in which thousands upon thousands come to give witness against the fourth beast. The fourth beast, that is to say, the Roman papal state, will be utterly destroyed, but the other nations and their regents will be allowed to live for a time, but their dominions shall be given to the saints to rule. This vision shows the fall of Rome once and for all, and the reign of the saints over the mortal nations after the judgment of the nations by the Ancient of Days, manifested in the flesh by the Son of Man, our Lord and Messiah. Chapter 8 deals with how these nations are viewed from above. Matthew 25, in the parable of the goats and the sheep, explicates how our Lord will judge the nations, sheep being good and goats being bad. Persia is deemed as a ram, or male sheep, with one horn greater than the other, representing the Persians over the Medes. Persia restored Judah and allowed the temple and the city of Jerusalem to be rebuilt. While not fully under its own control, the Jews prospered under Persian rule. We can testify to this fact because in the beginning of this chapter, Daniel uses Hebrew instead of Aramaic. The Aramaic language represents the Jews in captivity. Under the Persian regime, the Jews spoke Hebrew, as the books written during Persian rule are written in Hebrew, and not in the Aramaic spoken during the Babylonian captivity. Under Greece and Rome, the Jews again largely spoke Aramaic. Hebrew was only spoken amongst the Jewish elite in the times of our Lord, reminiscent of the later disparity between Latin and the common vernacular within the church. The Persian ram was killed by the goat. As a sheep is obedient to the ways of the shepherd, goats are stubborn and do as they wish. According to the parable, the goat nations will be destroyed and the sheep nations will be allowed to live. The large horn is Alexander the Great, who is broken in Babylon. The four horns represent the splitting of the conquered regions of Greece into four kingdoms, helmed by Alexander's four generals. Now many of us would identify the little horn growing from one of the horns as Rome. And indeed, there is a very good case for this. In order to invoke discussion, I will offer an alternative interpretation. The nations are represented by beasts, and the horns are the ruling authorities, regimes, or kings stemming from that nation. It seems necessary that Rome itself be represented by a different beast, such as another goat. The angel explains that this is a king which rises at the latter end of the Grecian kingdom, out of one of the other horns. Thus, the little horn would seem to be a Grecian ruler, just as the little horn with eyes in chapter 7 is a Roman ruler, i.e. the Pope. The vision relates the little horn growing toward the east, the south, and the Holy Land. This easily applies to the Seleucid Empire, one of the four horns. The little horn thus represents one of these kings who existed toward the latter days of that kingdom. According to the statements of the vision, there is one king who fits the description to a T, Antiochus IV, who stole the temple's treasures, tore down Jerusalem's city walls, installed a high priest who paid him to, slaughtered the Jews, ordered the scriptures to be destroyed, brought in soldiers to lay with prostitutes inside the temple in order to defile it, forced the Jews to worship Greek gods, established the Acra, or fortress, within the original city of David, and invoked the death penalty for those who observed circumcision, the Sabbath, or any other religious feast or sacrifices to the Father. Though not inspired, the Maccabean historical books say this about Antiochus. He thought that Judea was in revolt. Raging like a wild animal, he set out from Egypt and took Jerusalem by storm. He ordered his soldiers to cut down without mercy those whom they met and to slay those who took refuge in their houses. There was a massacre of young and old, a killing of women and children, a slaughter of virgins and infants. In the space of 3 days, 80,000 were lost, 40,000 meeting a violent death, and the same number being sold into slavery. Not long after this, the king sent an Athenian senator to force the Jews to abandon the customs of their ancestors and live no longer by the laws of God, also to profane the temple in Jerusalem and dedicate it to Olympian Zeus. and that on Mount Gerizim to Zeus the hospitable, as the inhabitants of the place requested. They also brought into the temple things that were forbidden, so that the altar was covered with abominable offerings prohibited by the laws. A man could not keep the Sabbath or celebrate the traditional feast, nor even admit that he was a Jew. At the suggestion of the citizens of Ptolemais, a decree was issued ordering the neighboring Greek cities to act in the same way against the Jews, obliged them to partake of the sacrifices, and put to death those who would not consent to adopt the customs of the Greeks. It was obvious, therefore, that disaster impended. Thus, two women who were arrested for having circumcised their children were publicly paraded about the city with their babies hanging at their breasts and then thrown down from the top of the city wall. Others, who had assembled in nearby caves to observe the Sabbath in secret, were betrayed to Philip and all burned to death. All this took place in 168 BC. And at the close of that year, Antiochus IV offered a pig to Zeus inside the temple, pushing the Jews to rebel in what is known as the Maccabean Revolt. 2300 days, or approximately 6 years and 4 months, after the defiling of the temple, the Maccabean Revolt succeeds in 162 BC, 6 years. And Seleucid general Lysias allows the temple to be cleansed and the Jews to practice their religion and reinstitute sacrifices. Antiochus IV died suddenly of disease in 164 BC, fulfilling the prophecy that he would be broken not by human hands. Now, this would be an actual realization of the vision. But there is a second interpretation. Yeshua is deemed the male lamb which was slain. Maturation of the body of that lamb, in other words, a ram, must then be the ecclesia of the Messiah. The ram of believers was skewered by Grecian philosophy and customs in what has become known as the Hellenizing of the Jews. While the physical temple was cleansed of the Greek paganism in 162 BC, the spiritual temple inside the Jews was still diluted with darkness, evident in the Pharisees and Sadducees. These Platonic doctrines later infiltrated the Christian community during and after the days of the apostles. The religious purity symbolized by the speaking of Hebrew in verses 1 through 12 has become the degrading of doctrine emphasized by the reemergence of the Aramaic tongue from verse 13 to the close of the book. If this is true, then the transgression of desolation, which is different from the abomination of desolation, caused by the Greek goat, is ongoing at the time of Yeshua. The very stamp of this desolation was the destruction of the Second Temple in 70 AD, spoken of in Daniel chapter 9 and affirmed by Christ in Matthew chapter 24. If the transgression that makes desolate the defilement of the temple by Antiochus represents the defilement of the spiritual temple inside the Jewish man by Greek myth and philosophy, then the culmination of that desolation, the destruction of the temple, and the abomination set up in place represents the abandonment of the Father by the Jews. Indeed, the old temple has been razed to the ground. A new temple, the body of Christ, has been built, which are those who put their faith in the Lord. So where do we mark? So where do we mark when the Jews became desolate? The dry ground from which the root of Jesse grew. The angel asks, how long from the transgression? The transgression, as we have seen, is at 168 BC. If we place the date again at 168 BC, being that this is the year Antiochus IV desolated the physical temple, we must then calculate 2300 times, making a day a year, from 168 BC. But this is not 2300 solar years, like the Babylonian years or the Julian years, of 365.25 days, but rather the biblical reckoning of a time at 360 days. Calculating 2300 biblical times is approximately 2,267 solar years. Adding 1 year, because there is no year zero, we arrive at the year 2100 AD. Now this date represents the cleansing of the sanctuary and the reinstitution of sacrifices. Thus it represents the start of the millennial reign. What this means then is that between now and 2100 AD, there will be the judgment of the saints, the repulsion of Gog, the rebuilding of Jerusalem and the temple, the battle of Armageddon, and the judgment of the nations. If this date is correct, it represents the cleansing of the world of all that is pagan and the ushering in of 1,000 years of peace. It also means that our Lord and Messiah is very soon to return, most likely within our lifetimes. Thank you.
We thank our brother for the opening remarks, and these two chapters are now open for discussion. So we welcome any comments or questions. Brother Ben.
Just a very brief comment, but as our brother pointed out about the Persians being represented by the bear and made a comment about the slowness, I had read somewhere and it got me thinking about Daniel obviously would have known about the overthrow of Babylon through what he had prophesied, and he knew what to look for. And to see Cyrus or Darius or the Medes and Persians go very methodically to all these different places and overthrow and working their way to Babylon but not really sure when they were going to get there, is not waiting for them to come to Babylon, because he knew that Babylon's time was coming. So it was just trying to be in his picture, being in his position, wondering how long Babylon would remain until it would be overthrown.
Brother Jim, some of you.
Brother Chairman, brother and sisters, can't help but be struck by Daniel's attitude to these visions that he had. He was deeply concerned at what he saw. He didn't look at these visions with indifference. He had an earnest desire to understand what they meant. He was troubled when he couldn't fathom it out. It wasn't, well, that was too difficult for me. That's too hard for me to grasp. I just can't get my mind around what that stuff means. He was deeply moved by it. He was greatly troubled. It's like John. I wept much when no one was able to open the seals. That these individuals, these worthies of old, were emotionally involved when they couldn't understand the things of God. And they had no rest until they could understand it. Verse 15, I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit within my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. So I came near to one of those who stood by and asked him the truth of all this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. And then we get two short verses of explanation, and that wasn't enough for him. Then I wished to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from the others. He still had questions. He was not satisfied. And then he closes the chapter with that same kind of a thought. This is the end of the account. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly troubled me, and my countenance was changed, but I kept the matter in my heart. And so we see the earnest desire to know and to understand the things of God. We're studying the book of Daniel. How many times have we put the book of Daniel aside and say, that's too complicated, there's too much in that, I don't understand it all? Or do we, like Daniel, bothered by the fact that I don't understand that vision, and I got to do something about it because I better understand it. It was given to us to understand, and if we don't understand it, then learn it. Shame on us. Let's get busy and understand it to the best of our ability. That's what's expected of us.
Brother Philip Hughes.
I'd like to thank Brother Aaron for the digest that he's given to us this morning. I mean, I think all the brethren this week have had an enormous task in trying to epitomize the various things in the chapter. And to do two chapters in that, in the space of 15 minutes, was excellent. And the historical detail that he brought out was really, really good, and I enjoyed listening to that very much. he did want some thought-provoking discussion. And so I thought I might make a few comments upon the latter part of Brother Aaron's remarks. I must admit I'd not heard the exposition that he'd given there with regards to Antiochus Epiphanes. At least I'm not particularly conscious of having considered it. And I think the thing that strikes us with the book of Daniel, and we've been looking at this during the course of the week, is the fact that we can see many lessons within the book. We see some basic concepts quite clearly portrayed in the chapters, and then we see various types and shadows which emerge as a result of those considerations. The scriptures always remind us of holding a diamond up to the light, though I've never had a diamond to do that, but it actually shines in many different ways, and we can see the various facets of the truth in embryo in different ways. So the thoughts that Brother Aaron gave with regards to the little horn of the east is something that I would need to think carefully about. And so I would just like, in these comments here, just to remind the brethren and sisters of the traditional exposition of Brother Thomas on that little horn. And I believe they are satisfactory in as much that they marry both the western little horn and the eastern little horn together. And we can get quite confused, because the western horn was that which arose upon the head of the beast and over plucked up three horns in his place, and it had the eyes and the mouth. That was the western horn, which Brother Aaron quite indicated developed into that harlot system of the papacy, and which had power to practice and prosper against the saints of the Most High, and spoke great words of blasphemy. And our benefit in recognizing the true expositions of Daniel and the Apocalypse is that we have a true and correct view of the system of Catholicism as presented to us faithfully in the scriptures and expounded by Brother Thomas and supported by Brother Robert. As for this latter, as for the eastern little horn, which arose out of the goat, which in turn came from the four horns that came up after the notable horn of Alexander was broken, we consider in the 23rd verse of chapter 8, in the latter, as the angel was giving this exposition now to Daniel, an explanation in the latter time of their kingdom. So this isn't the latter days, this is the latter time of their kingdom. And we would suggest that that's being referred to of the time when the Roman Empire was now beginning to come forward, and the Grecian element was to diminish quite significantly at the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors had come to the full. The transgressors there are the people of Israel. And I think Brother Aaron made a very important point in this eighth chapter. We're now looking not just purely at the Gentiles, but we're looking at the people of the Most High. We're looking at Israel. And it's when they, as the transgressors, this time of transgression in Israel was coming to the full, and we know it was completely manifested in the time when they crucified the Lord Jesus Christ. A king of fierce countenance shall stand up, understanding dark sentences. And we believe that that king there is the king that was standing up then was the Roman power that would manifest itself and come to the zenith in the imperial Rome under the Caesars, and which manifested themselves greatly. And his power shall be mighty, as Rome's was mighty, and we are reminded of the legs of iron. This was a powerful system that was to be manifested, but not by his own power. Not by his own power, because the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and setteth up over it whom he will, even the lowest and the basest of men. It was the deity who was in control of affairs, and he allowed the development of this powerful Roman system. And he shall destroy wonderfully, which he did. His destruction was even manifested to the temple in Jerusalem in AD 70, when the sanctuary was broken down and destroyed. He shall prosper and practice and to destroy the mighty and the holy people. We know it was Rome who actually destroyed this little horn of the East power, which had now manifested itself, destroyed the power of Israel, destroyed the temple, and later in about, I can't remember exactly the date, was it about 110, 120, 130 AD, when, I can't remember even the emperor's name, ploughed Jerusalem with salt. His name, the emperor, comes from my mind. We know it was Titus in AD 70 that destroyed Jerusalem. But Hadrian. Hadrian actually ploughed Jerusalem with salt and made it illegal for any Jew to actually enter into Jerusalem. So he destroyed the holy people. And through his policy shall he cause craft to prosper. And Brother Thomas, I think it's in Exposition of Daniel, but it may be in Eureka, he indicates that this little horn power was now to become a series of powers. That it was pagan in its outset, indicated by Imperial Rome, but it was this pagan Roman system that caused craft to prosper. Priestcraft. This was the Roman Catholic system. And men, emperors in Constantinople, like Justinian, who made his pragmatic sanctions and his decree in 533 AD, and later Phocas in 606 AD or thereabouts, making the Pope universal bishop, caused Catholicism to prosper and practice in the empire. And as it went on, we know that it developed into the Holy Roman Empire. But that little horn power was first pagan, it became Catholic, and ultimately it became Ottoman when the Ottomans the Ottoman power overthrew Constantinople in 1458. So Brother Thomas indicates that whoever occupies Constantinople, which became the headquarters of the dragon power, that was the little horn of the beast. And it's married up in the fact that it is still the same, it's still connected to the same fourth beast Roman power, whether it was the Catholic little horn of the West or this pagan power that arose in the East. It's still that same fourth beast power that developed and caused the Catholic system to grow and prosper. Ultimately, Brother Thomas indicates that it will be occupied by the Russian Empire as it comes down and occupies Constantinople, and we don't want to say too much about that because we know that Daniel chapter 11 talks about the King of the North and the King of the South at the time of the end. When he and Brother Thomas, you remember in Elpis Israel, gives that indication of the fret saw, he says, cutting out of the horn power and the little horn that emerged from it. And when the King of the North comes down, that little horn power will be suppressed and become the King of the North. And the whole system then is married up, and we believe that Brother Thomas is absolutely right in his exposition, and we would like to exhort the brothers and sisters to stick closely to that exposition.
Brother Curtis.
This is a little bit of a change of subject, but Matthew Hughes gave me this to show everyone, I think. It's the Nevinitis. It's a replica of the Nevinitis cylinder that we talked about yesterday. And of course, even in the chapters today, we're talking about this dream was during the time of Belshazzar. So at one time, they didn't think Belshazzar even existed. And on this Nevinitis cylinder that they found in 1854, it said, get this right, Belshazzar, the firstborn son, the offspring of my heart. And that's what Nevinitis wrote on this cylinder. And they found this. I don't know if we were discussing, I don't know if it was this small or not. It was. And I think it is in the British Museum. I think that's the real thing in the British Museum. That's not a replica. I think that's what I have in note, that it's in the British Museum. Matthew may have more comments. But anyway, if anybody would like to look at this cylinder, Matthew handed it over here so I could say something about it, but it's over here, and so if anybody would like to look at it, here it is.
have any other comments or questions? Now, we'd heard the brethren talking about the Constantinople, and I think that today is Istanbul. That's right. Brother Aaron. Now he's coming.
Some people interpret the 2300 days because it's literally evening mornings as 1150 days. And if we don't do the solar years, but if we do 360 days, we get approximately 1134 solar years. You add that to 70 AD, that the destruction of the Second Temple, and you get 1204, and 1204 is the year that the Christians in the Fourth Crusade sacked Constantinople.
Brother Matthew Hughes.
Reflect the thanks of Brother Philip to Brother Aaron for his remarks on that subject. And I mean, these really are, perhaps we could say, the two most difficult chapters of Daniel. Chapter 11 gets pretty tricky as well, and chapter 12 also has some challenges with the time frames. But this chapter, really, I think. In my opinion, chapter 8 is amongst the most difficult. But certainly I think if we understand this to be Rome, this little horn, I think we do have a good historical context for it. And I think there's a lot of exhortation we can draw from the latter days, the last days of Judah's commonwealth. And, you know, in verse 23, it says, in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance, etc., etc. Brother Thomas translates that, so as to cause transgressors to fill up their measure. And that's what Christ said. He said to the scribes and Pharisees, fill ye up the measure of your fathers. And that's exactly what was happening, you know, we get some sort of idea, if we look between the testaments at what was going on in Jewry, of the parched condition of spiritual Israel. You know, we read in Isaiah that Christ was a root out of a dry place. You know, and there were factions within Jewry. You had the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the scribes, you know, the Grecian sympathizers, the Roman sympathizers, Herodians, and so forth. But truth holders, they were few. And you know, we just have those handful of people who are following round Jesus from place to place, you know, rather a paltry group of people when we put them alongside the rest of people. And then we see in verse 25, I'm not absolutely sure here, and maybe someone can expand on this a bit further, but I've got a note against that word, by peace shall he destroy many. I've got, in prosperity he shall destroy many. And maybe the idea there is that Israel, in their brief time of prosperity after, you know, the emancipation and independence they got through the Maccabees, had actually degenerated, and you know, the prosperity was what really rotted the Jews from within then. And if that is the case, which it might not be, someone might stand up to correct me here, but if that is the case, it is again another exhortation to us. We think of James, who was talking to the Israelites at the time, or the believers, and in making reference to the rich Sadducees, perhaps, and the Pharisees, who he said, do not rich men persecute you? He said, go to now, ye rich men, weep and howl for the miseries that shall come upon you. Ye have heaped up treasures for the last days. And that's exactly what happened in the invasion of Rome when they sacked Jerusalem. You know, the rich Jews who had perhaps been guilty of persecuting the Christians were amongst those who suffered the most intensely and under the Romans. I forgot to mention as well. Thanks, Brother Curtis, for the remarks on the cylinder. And I was speaking to Sister Alison earlier, who has a better memory than me, and she said that she remembers the cylinder being that size in the museum. So yeah, that's kind of life size. Pretty interesting.
Brother Joel Pando.
One of the things, I guess, that would have been maybe a little easier if we would have been able to cover one chapter at a time, because again, it's, I think what Brother Matthew said, it's pretty intense in getting to these two chapters, and especially considering them together. One of the things that I try to do, I think, in trying to, I guess, differentiate the two horns between the horn of the beast, which is in chapter 7, and the horn of the goat, which I think Brother Philip referred to as the goat of the horn of the east, is that it's just the horn of the beast arises out of the Roman Empire. So that you have the progression of, you know, it stamped to the ground and it grew, and that little horn that stamped three out would be the papacy, and it continues. So that will be different from, again, chapter 8, where you have the horn of the goat, that in which one horn arises out of that Grecian element. So that will be the as I think Philip said, the Roman element, or the Roman empire that came out of that Grecian side. I've heard some of the comments by Brother Aaron, and I've heard them before, and I've read some of the commentaries, I think, relate to that. Although I personally feel Brother Thomas' exposition is probably the best that I've seen or even gone close to reading related to these chapters. And it's probably a little bit, to me, better to take a broader view of the aspect related to the horns, at least as far as a broader perspective of history, than just little the narrow view that I think related to Antiochus Epiphanes. And maybe in the literal sense, but in the spiritual, the more symbolic sense, I think the broader view would probably be better. Now, they want to relate, make a real quick comment on the 2300 or 2400, I think, but it, Brother Thomas said it was 2400, and I think the majority of manuscripts had 2300, so I think I personally feel it was 2300. And the question is, well, how do you calculate the time? I think Brother Thomas had it from 540 BC to about 1820, when the Egyptian, something happened in Egypt, I can't remember exactly how, what happened. But you have to take the 2300, which, let's say that it is the actual time. When do you start calculating it from, and when does it end? Again, if the vision lasted that long, you have two options. One is when Daniel saw the vision, which was probably 540 BC. But you could also take it as the vision started when he saw the goat trampling upon the beast, upon the ram. So if you take that time, the time of Alexander the Great, 320, I think it was around 320-something, you calculate that, and you may come up to around the time of the 1967 war or something. I think I made some calculations, but there are some very, I think, highlights related to the Jews, related to the daily sacrifice and the avenging. I think it should be the word of the day of the temple, of sanctuary.
Brother Aaron.
Speaking about where to place the 2300 days, the question asks, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? It seems to me he's asking from the actual transgression point, not from when the goat killed the ram, or from when Daniel saw the vision. He's asking when, from when the sanctuary and the host be trodden underfoot. And the other angel answers 2,300 days or evening mornings.
Brother David Hughes.
Yeah, I think I share Brother Joel's views on it. The significance of 1967, which if you take 2,300 from that, you go back to BC 333, which is the which was the Battle of Issus. The Greek power under Alexander undertook three military campaigns against the Persians, which ultimately ended in the destruction of the Persian power. It wasn't a destruction of Persia as such, but it brought to an end the Persian Empire, and that was the Battle of Granicus in BC 334, the Battle of Issus in BC 333, and the Battle of Gaugamela in BC 331. And I think it's felt by most brethren today that the Battle of Issus was the most significant. And as the Greeks were particularly anti-Semitic, they established this sort of desolation in the Holy Land, particularly in Jerusalem. As Brother Aaron pointed out, they sacrificed a pig on the altar in the temple to Zeus. So they sort of really started an anti-Jewish sort of campaign in the world's empires, which I think we can see an end in 1967 when Jerusalem was liberated by the Jews. The Arabs were the ones who actually started the war, and they lost. So the Jews, through much loss of blood, managed to liberate Jerusalem. So I sort of see as 1967 being an end of the 2,300 as opposed to 2,400 or anything else. Secondly, this little horn of the goat, which has already been discussed, probably I'll be duplicating some of what Brother Philip has said. This little horn of the goat was essentially the Roman element arising out of the northern horn of the goat. As Brother Aaron pointed out, the notable horn, which is Alexander the Great, was broken. He had no posterity to take over his position, so he had four generals. If we turn later in Daniel, where we read of the kings of the north and the king of the north and the king of the south, that is actually an extension of this vision, because you have only the king of the north and the king of the south on the arena. And Brother Thomas indicates that that's because these kings were the ones in relation to the Holy Land. Only two out of the four had any bearing upon God's people. For whatever reason, the two other generals and their posterity had no impact as far as God's people were concerned. So you have the king of the north and the king of the south, and Daniel chapter 8 tells us out of one of these horns, which Brother Thomas identifies as the northern horn, arose a little horn. This little horn, as we will see, was not... this little horn was the Romans. This power, unlike the Greeks, unlike the Persians, they did not come from some other country and break and conquer the power as such. What we see is the power of the Romans within the northern territory of the Greek Empire become stronger and stronger and stronger until they actually broke the power of the Greeks. And Rome then became the empire of the world, typified by the fourth beast. That's the situation as we have it today. And of course, being as it is the king of the north, the Turks, the Turkoman, eventually became the sort of residence in the regions of the king of the north. And what we are seeing, or what we have seen for the last 200 years, is the breaking of the Turkish power in readiness for the Russian to become the king of the north. Because when the Russian becomes the king of the north, that little horn, as we understand it in this symbol, disappears. Brother Thomas uses that analogy of a circular saw. He said if you took one of the horns, which again is the northern horn, take a little circular saw and cut out a little piece out of that horn and stick it to a spring, hold it down, and that's how you have the situation in the world then with the four horns. But release it, and that's the situation that we have with the Roman power, which has lasted up until this day. Put your finger on that piece and push it back in again, and you've lost that little horn, which is essentially the Russian power coming down, establishing themselves in Constantinople, which became, as Brother Philip pointed out, the sort of headquarters of the eastern horn, this little horn of the goat, not the western horn, the eastern horn of the goat. And you have the Russians, which obviously, without stealing too much from the addresses later on this week, will become the antagonist of not just the Holy Land, but the King of the South, who we believe are Tarshish and the Young Lions.
You have other comments? Brother Aaron?
I realize that you're using the 1967 as evidence to the sanctuary being cleansed on verse 14, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. It seems to me that while Jerusalem was retaken, half of it still belongs to Palestinians, and the city of David is split up, and the temple or the Dome of the Rock is sitting where the Holy Temple should be. So I'm not really seeing how 1967, while it's an important date in Israel's history, is the significant end to the 2300 days.
Brother Jim Phillips.
The other problem with 1967 is it really doesn't come to 333, it comes to 334 when you add back in the year zero. So it was not that that's a significant thing prophetically, but it is late. As the brethren pointed out, it's really a hard chapter to discern. I'm never really satisfied myself whether the interpretation Brother Aaron gave us is correct or the one Brother Thomas has is correct. I can see the strengths in both points of view. If we could settle on the prophecy of the 2300 and get that one, that prophecy resolved, it would be a lot easier to figure out exactly which. Brother Joel mentioned Brother Thomas uses 2400 instead of 2300. It comes from a Septuagint reading. It might be the best reading. And if that's the case, then the little horn is Roman, as Brother Thomas points out. If we start it with the end of the or the beginning of the Persian dates, Brother Thomas used 540 as the beginning of the Persian dates. I think we're pretty sure now that the start of that is 534. Brother Thomas' time then ended in 1960, which he saw as the or 1860, which he saw as the confusion with the Civil War. If you use the 534 date, it comes to 1867, which is the loss of papal power, the loss of the temporal power, such as Brother Aaron was speaking about, how the Pope had lost his temporal power. So the 2400 does give us a reasonable time frame from the Persian Empire, start of the Persian Empire, to the loss of the papal power by the Pope. As Brother Joel pointed out, the 2400 is a minority reading. It only occurs, I think, in two other manuscripts.